Hello everybody, welcome to Coffee Time with Byron. I am your host, Byron. This is episode number 99, real close to that 100 mark. I don't know who special I'm going to have yet, but who knows? You never know. But joining me now via StreamYard, live on YouTube, at Coffee Time with Byron. Also available next day on all podcasting apps, Google, Spotify, Apple, iHeart. You name it, and now if you have an Alexa, you can say Coffee Time with Byron, and you can play us there. So it's a win-win. If you got Alexa, there you go. But alongside me is current independent pitcher, former major leaguer, once again, Major League Baseball again, Blaine Hardy. Thank you for joining me. How are you tonight?
I'm doing great. You know, it's always fun to shoot the baseball talk with someone that shares my passions. So, you know, I've seen that you've done all sorts of range of sports, whether it be, you know, hockey, football, baseball.
Yep. I try to.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, all professional athletes, you know, have their own stories, their own past. And, you know, for fans to be able to find a way to learn more is, you know, always great. So
I've even done some MMA fighters.
That would probably be an even more interesting listen. So.
Oh yeah, without a doubt, there's definitely some interest in there. Yeah, there's definitely some interesting stories I've heard from some of the ones I've had on. For sure.
I believe it.
So let's get right to it. I know you're playing. So let's get right to your current status right now. Independent ball, where you're playing for, I think it sucks.
The Sioux City Explorers.
So tell us about that. And have you been scouted yet by any teams? Because I know this is independent ball, and I know they send scouts out there to scout talent. Have you been scouted yet?
The answer is no. And the only reason, well, I can't say the only reason, but one of the main factors in that is that the independent league actually doesn't start for another 3.5 weeks. So May 4th will be our report date. And then they do like an expedited spring training like thing for each team in that league. And then I believe they start up 2 weeks after that.
So are you still looking to go back to the majors? Obviously, your career is not done. You're still young. So is that your ultimate goal, is to get back to the major league level?
Yeah, I would say anyone who is, you know, just in their mid-30s and is choosing to play independent ball, their goal is more than likely to make it back to the major leagues. The first step from independent ball would obviously be to make it back into Major League Baseball with respect to like AA, AAA, to hit that stepping stone to possibly get back to the big leagues. I can't say if it's ever happened, but I would be more than willing to say that there probably haven't been too many guys signed out of independent ball that were put straight into the big leagues.
Right.
But, you know, usually they're added as depth or, you know, just happen to find a little extra velo or a little bit extra spin on their pitches to, you know, push themselves back onto the radar with these major league teams.
So now I got to ask you, I'm going to put you on the spot here, since you are back in independent ball and you're in your late 30s, do you think you will ever get back into the MLB? Do you think you'll ever play a game back in the majors?
For me, baseball has always been a right time, right place type of sport. You know, unless you're a high draft pick where the investment is there by the teams to, you know, try and, you know, nudge these players, maybe even if they're not ready. For a guy like me, you know, I've spent my career proving to people that, you know, I can pitch in the big leagues, and I did it successfully. And for me, I think there's a possibility of me still making it back to the major leagues. The odds are slowly ticking away, just because of age. Right. And then the lockout went this year, you know, kind of made it a little bit hard for a guy like me to find a team, because I technically wasn't allowed to sign until that CBA was agreed upon. Right. And the group of guys I was competing with for jobs in the off season, if they didn't have any big league time last year, they were able to sign through that lockout. So those jobs were filling up without me being capable of actually trying to land one of those. So, you know, my wife, Nikki, and I came to the conclusion that if I want to prove to teams that I still can pitch at a high caliber, and even at the big league caliber, I need to get myself out there playing games, even if it is an independent ball. So with that being said, you know, I think I wanted to be somewhat close to home because we live up in Minnesota. Right. And the best fit that my agent and I and my wife came to the conclusion was Sioux City, because their head coach and their pitching coach are pretty good at not just tinkering with pitchers, but also, you know, helping guys potentially get back to the major league side of baseball.
Not bad. I can agree with you that that's what they're there for, to help guys like you get back into the majors. Now, have you met any of your teammates yet? Have you reported yet? I know they have to have like some kind of spring training that, like the majors, don't they?
And that will start on the 4th of May. Until then, we're trying to wrap up as many projects as we can at home. And I've been going into town to throw at Central Lakes College twice a week to live hitters to keep myself as ready as possible for the quick startup that independent ball does have. I have not met any of my teammates because I'm still at home.
Right.
But I have talked with a few former teammates across, I don't know how many years it was, 14 years in professional baseball, that will actually be in that league that I'll be playing against. So it'll be fun to cross paths once again with, you know, former players that I've played with. You know, baseball is such a small world that it'll catch you by surprise. I know when I was in Nashville last year, I think I ran across at least 20 former teammates that were scattered across the league on different teams that I didn't know were still playing. So,
right. So now tell us about your college experience, because according to this, you transferred at, looks like, three different kind of schools. So tell us about your college career, and did that ultimately help you get scouted to where you got drafted eventually by the Tigers?
Yeah, you know, I think the path that I took with respect to college, college was a little bit more difficult for me, mainly because, you know, my focus was baseball. I knew that if I pushed myself hard enough, I'd potentially have the chance to get drafted. But when you try and juggle that with a computer science degree, it gets a little tough. So when I was at University of Portland, you know, my first semester was good, put up good grades. And then once baseball kind of came around, I noticed my focus go more towards baseball, and it made that computer science degree just almost impossible to obtain at the same time. So I made the smart move, and I went to Bellevue Community College after that to get my schooling back in order. And then after that, I went to Lewis Clark State College, which had a very high draft rate. I think they're drafting 7 to 8 players out of that school every year for an NAIA. That's, you know, kind of unheard of, but they were also known to be one of the best NAIAs out there. So I got that almost immediately once the season started with Lewis and Clark. And, you know, I probably had four or five teams actually like come out and personally like sit down with me and talk with me about, you know, what are my thoughts? Am I wanting to pursue professional baseball? I'm, well, absolutely. And then the team that drafted me, which was the Royals, I don't even think I had them in the back of my head because I had teams saying, oh, we're going to take you, you know, somewhere in like the 10th to 15th round. And once all those were passed and we were all the way down to the 20th, the 21st, 22nd, I was starting to think that I was going to have to play another year at Lewis Clark. But then in the 22nd, you know, the Royals called and said, hey, we're going to sign you. And, you know, that's one of the coolest calls that you can ever have. What was funny about it is I was up in Canada playing summer ball, and you know, when you get a phone call from a number you don't recognize, it, you're worried about the roaming charges and all that stuff. And I was like, I need to make sure that this isn't, you know, a team call. And sure enough, it was.
It happened to be the Royals, huh?
Yep, and it was the Royals.
There you go. So in 2008, you're a part of, like you said, the, you were, since you played for Lewis Clark, you won the championship in 2008 with them at that World Series. Tell us about that year and winning that, the Intercollegiate World Series. Was that on your accolades?
Well, you know, it's funny because when I was at Bellevue, because I was a transfer, the coach was hesitant to use me over his guys that he had had there for, you know, a couple of years already. I still had to pitch, but it wasn't, I think I only threw like 11 or 12 innings. And we actually won a championship there. So then I go to Lewis Clark, and our team, I'm not going to say steamrolled most of the teams we played during the regular season. So to be bumped into a higher level of baseball, only for, you know, the World Series, I think it made it a little bit more difficult for players to adjust. I mean, we had a fantastic team, but I don't remember what round we lost our first game in, but when we got to play, we were the last of two teams, and the way the playoffs or the World Series was set up is that it was double elimination. Well, we had to beat that team twice in a row. And I think the first game against them, they must have been beating us by, you know, three or four runs going late into the game. And our team just went off and scored like five or six to give us the lead. And I think once we did that, we just crushed their dreams of having that World Series. And going into the next game, all the momentum was on our side, and we ended up being champions. So
there you go. And then, like you said, you're drafted in the 22nd round of the 08 draft. Where you appear with the Northwest Arkansas Naturals, their Double A team, in 09. So tell us about playing for, and you also appear in the AAA Omaha Royals that year as well, but you don't make it to the big leagues with them. So tell us about your minor league experience with the Royals and ultimately what led to you getting released by them.
It was a very roller coaster type scenario where my first year they sent me straight to rookie ball in Idaho Falls. I had a good year. The following year was one of my better, I would say, years early on in my career with the Royals when I was in Burlington, Iowa, playing low A ball. And the whole, like, halfway through the year, I assumed that I was going to get called up. But, you know, they had so many prospects in high A in Wilmington that I was never given a shot. So going into spring training, you know, I just assumed, okay, well, you know, I'll probably be going to Wilmington this year. And I actually skipped high A and went straight to double A and started out really hot and, you know, got called up triple A and was doing really well there too. And there was no room in the bullpen in the big leagues. And I was putting up really good numbers. And they came up to me and they said, well, we don't have room in the pen, but we would like a lefty starter. Like, do you want to start? And of course, I'm like, well, absolutely. Starting's, you know, obviously one of the things that I wish I would have been doing before that for the last 3 years.
Right.
And they put me in the starting role. I think they gave me, 45 pitches for my first start, and I used them all up in the first. and, you know, it was one of those things where, you know, that may have hindered my possibility of making it to the big leagues earlier in my career, but I was ultimately just a fastball changeup lefty with below average breaking ball. And I have a feeling if I would have made it to the big leagues that early, who's to say I'd still be around playing baseball. So, over the following couple of years, I was bouncing back and forth between double A and triple A. And, it was one of the spring trainings, the big league pitching coach sat me down and basically just, we were hammering into my head, like how to throw a good curveball. And finally he said something and it clicked. And that curveball is actually what got me to the big leagues. Now, obviously wasn't with the Royals because, you know, I got released by them. I think it's funny how those kind of paths kind of lay themselves out to, you know, further your career. And like, it was heartbreaking to get released. And like,
I bet
they were upset about it too. Like, they sat me down in the office and JJ Piccolo and Scott Sharp, and basically said, look, we don't have anywhere to put you. Like, we got already four lefties in the bullpen in AAA, and we're going to give you a quick release. That way you can hopefully land with another team. So I think there's 10 days left in spring training, and I guess I spent the first 2 or 3 days getting call after call from independent ball teams, and I'm just sitting there going, is this really where my career is going to end? And then the Tigers called and said, have you signed with anyone yet? I said, no. They're like, do you want to? Yeah. So hopped in my nice little Hyundai Tiburon and made the drive from Arizona to Florida with a pit stop in Omaha. So it was like a 3.5 to 4 day trip to get over there. But I was in extended spring training for a week or two. And then they sent me to Erie, Pennsylvania. And, you know, that was the moment where I realized I need to push myself to be the best I can be. Did really well in Erie, went to Toledo, which to this day, like, I loved pitching in Toledo. It was, you know, great fans, great ballpark. And we obviously have a lot of memories there because between Detroit and Toledo, you know, that was years 2013 to 19. So, but no, it was fun.
It's funny how you said that, because now they told you there wasn't enough room. Yeah, because that was before they went to, that was basically their years before they went to the World Series with all them good players.
Played with pretty much all those guys. They were moving up at the same pace as me. I mean, you know, when I signed, I was in Idaho Falls, we were all anticipating Hosmer signing, And he waited till the very last day. And I don't even think he played. I think he showed up and then they decided that it'd be better for him to just go get his work in Arizona. But,
yeah.
You know, and then like moving forward, you know, Moustakas, Salvador, you know, all those guys moved up at the same speed. And then all of a sudden, you know, they had a World Series team.
Yep. I know. It's crazy how it goes. And then all of a sudden it went downhill again. Now, obviously you spent spring training with them all those years you were with them. Did you honestly think in your mind you literally had a shot to make it to your major league debut with them before the Tigers called upon and you made your debut with them? But all those spring trainings, you felt like you had a good enough spring training to make the team and have that call up by the Royals?
With respect to spring training, no. My spring training track record isn't necessarily the best, but, you know, when I was with the Royals, because of how quickly I moved up to AAA and realizing I was the like youngest player on the team, the first year I got called up to AAA, you know, my hopes were high. And then as all those young players moves up at the same pace as me, and then all of a sudden, you know, me being the youngest to me being like, you know, fourth, fifth youngest to me being like closer to, you know, the middle of the pack, you know, that reality hit pretty quick. And because of that, I still knew I had the ability to pitch in the major leagues. I just didn't know if I was going to get my shot. And then when I got released, I realized that, okay, well, you know, there are 29 other teams. There's a possibility. And when I ended up with the Tigers, you know, I actually thought my first year with them, I was going to get a chance. And I didn't, but, you know, at the time, they were a playoff contender, so they weren't messing around when it came to September call-ups. You know, they were going to call up the guys that they thought could actually help the team in the playoffs. And then in 14, I couldn't tell you which number of reliever I was to get called up, but, you know, it was close to 13 or 14, because, you know, they couldn't find a good fit from anyone. And, you know, the phone finally rang and my name was called, and, you know, I made the best of it and, you know, proved that I could pitch at the big league level.
So, yeah, like you said, you unfortunately you get cut by the Royals in 13, and then the Tigers sign you where, like you said, you get sent to Erie, their double A team. You go 2-2 with a 163 as a reliever, and then they transfer you over to starter at the AAA level for the Toledo, and you went 8-3 with a 167. Do you think that year, because that's a very good year, either in any league or even MLB for that matter, that's still a good season. Do you think that ultimately helped you to your debut in 2014 with the team? Do you think that year helped you a lot?
100%. I guarantee you that my name was being mentioned in 13 for potentially getting called up. But when I didn't get called up, you know, I obviously knew that as long as I could continue to have that success the following year, that I should potentially get my opportunity, and I did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because in 2014, you were non-roster invitee, and you impressed them as a wrong reliever. So then they, at the end of spring training, they send you back to the minors, but then you make your debut June 14th of 04 with the Detroit Tigers in a game against the Royals. Go figure, a team that cuts you. So tell us about your major league debut. How'd that come about, and who called you when you got the call that you were going to be called up to the pitch that day?
Well, you know, it's it's funny how coincidental baseball can be, and to get called up against my former team that, you know, I think that in truth itself made my debut a lot easier because I was facing guys that I had played with forever. Mm-hmm. And to be able to go out there and not be completely anxious with, you know, the big stage and the big crowd and, you know, these big league hitters. I knew these guys. Like, I wasn't having to go out there and, you know, face guys that I had looked up to, you know, my whole life, and then all of a sudden be pitching against, you know, some legends. And mind you, like, they had certain guys that I had already looked up to that were in the big leagues, but yeah. I mean, at the time, I think the scariest hitter that I had to face was Alex Gordon,
right?
On that roster,
right.
And I got to see him in Omaha
as a teammate, and
like his route was a very interesting one because I believe he was originally a third baseman. They didn't see him furthering his career at third base, so they sent him down to Omaha to learn how to play outfield. Well, his first couple games were kind of rough out there, but the amount of work he put in and then to see how quickly he transitioned and obviously became a Gold Glover, you know, that just shows you that even the guys that get drafted so high still have adversity that they got to face.
Right.
He inspired guys like me and other guys that, you know, you put the work in and you'll be rewarded.
So who ultimately gave you that call that you were calling up, and did you end up having all your family there for that day when you finally got the word that you were going to pitch?
I didn't have my entire family, but my dad and my wife were there. She was my girlfriend at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And I still go back and I watch, you know, that video because it pans to them like they always do for people's debuts.
Right, right.
And it was fun to see how nervous they were, more nervous than I was, to say the least.
Of course, that's how it always goes.
Yeah, and to see how nervous they were and to know, like, I had nerves, but I wasn't nearly as nervous as them,
right,
just kind of sets in the reality of, you know, I was built to be a major league pitcher, so.
Yeah. And so you stayed with them that whole, staying with them the rest of the year. It was a nice debut, though, I gotta say. You allowed one hit. You pitched two scoreless innings, you walked two, struck out two, and then for the rest of that year, you posted a 2.54 ERA and 39 innings pitched. That's fairly a good rookie year, I'd say, don't you?
No, absolutely. No, and I've seen time and time again pitchers that I think have the capabilities to have had the career that I had, but because their debut didn't go so well because of the nerves. You know, they get sent right back down to AAA, and then all of a sudden that's in the back of their mind for the rest of their career.
Right. Right.
You know, and these are guys that are more in my draft range where we're talking, you know, 20s and higher, where they pitch so well in AAA and they do so well, you know, navigating a full season, staying healthy, you know, putting up great numbers, and they get that one opportunity to go up to the big leagues and prove that they can do it up there. And then, you know, they will just throw some random numbers out there, but say they pitch one inning when, you know, in a game that doesn't matter, and they give up, you know, 2, 3, 4 runs, and they might not ever make it back to the big leagues again. Or
right,
they do, you know, a couple of years down the road. But, yeah, I mean, it was I was very fortunate to have had the start to my career that I did.
And the following year in 2015, you make the roster for opening day, but it was held back due to a minor injury. What exactly did you have that caused you to make the major league roster for opening day? What was that injury that you had?
I think it was my shoulder.
Shoulder?
I think I had a shoulder impingement. And like I to this day still have, you know, a lot of work put in front of me to make sure that my shoulder is staying healthy. Mm-hmm. When you're young and dumb, you really don't focus as much as you should until, you know, you have something pop up.
Right.
And that's exactly what happened with me. You know, in, I think it was 15, me and Alex Wilson, I don't think they expected us to throw as much as we did, but I think I had 70 appearances with 60 innings and he had 60 appearances with 70 innings. Mm-hmm. And both of us were hurting a little bit the next spring training. He obviously was able to get healthy for the start of the season, but it took me a little bit of time to get my shoulder up to speed. So
now tell me about this. If I don't know if you knew anything about this, but on August 23rd of that year, you had a homerless streak of 84 and two-thirds innings, but it was broken up by a home run due to Mike Napoli, and it happened to be the largest active homerless streak in the major leagues. Did you have any idea about that record going in before that home run?
Oh, yeah. When it hits the media tries to avoid bringing up, you know, the elephant in the room. But someone always slips up. So I think once I got to like 50 or 60 innings, it was constantly snuck around into conversations, whether they be interviews or just, you know, talking with the reporters on the side.
Right.
And, you know, I distinctly remember the home run that I gave up to Napoli, because when he hit it, I thought there was no chance, and it just snuck over the wall in left field, and, you know, there went that streak. But yeah, you know, to have accomplished that was you know, one of the big highlights of my career.
Yeah, because it says right here you hold the most record with that homerless streak. You you held the record for most appearance by a left-hander without allowing a home run at 87 appearances, two away from tying their Bernie Bolin's record for 89. So that's quite impressive streak you boiled up there, because that's pretty hard to do, not allowing a home run. That's pretty tough for most pitchers.
Absolutely. Especially, you know, in that era of baseball.
Exactly.
It was difficult, and once they changed the balls a few years later, I don't see a streak like that happening. It doesn't matter how good of a pitcher you are. You know,
not going to happen again, no.
Yeah, the homers are going to keep going up, so.
Yeah. So you would go off to finish that year with a 3.08 ERA, striking out 55 and 61 in the third innings, and you appeared in 70 games. That's one hell of an actual rookie season, to be honest, because that technically was your first rookie year, because you played the most games compared to the following year, which you were just coming in half the year. So this was, I say, by far your official rookie year, wouldn't you say?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, it was one of those things where I say it's a right place, right time type of sport. With the success that I was having, the success that Alex was having, we made the most out of the opportunities that were provided for us.
And then 2016, unfortunately, you get called back to AAA, which you start the year there. But then you make 7 appearances, and you get called up again by the Tigers in August. And you pitch your first appearance since that last year. You pitch against the Seattle Mariners. And in that year, you made 21 appearances. Tell us about that year, 2016, that you ultimately weren't called up until half the year. Now, what happened there?
You know, it's the fun thing about baseball. You know, baseball has a tendency of trying to pass you by. But, you know, I made the most of trying to get myself back to where I was a year before. And, you know, when I finally made it back up, I think I did just that. And then, you know, if you move farther down the road, 18 was probably the most upsetting year because I had my sights on being able to, you know, have a full year in the big leagues. Yeah. And I ended up getting taken off the 40-man. Even with the arbitration contract that we had in place. So it made sense because I didn't necessarily have the best year in 17. So they were able to give me a split contract for my arbitration case. And that ultimately was what led to, you know, them deciding that I was going to go to AAA. And probably one of the better things that could have happened because I went there and I just said, I'm going to have as much fun as I can in AAA and we're going to see where it goes. And sure enough, I think I started the AAA season pitching really, really well, especially as a starter. Mm-hmm. And it led to me getting my first starts in the big leagues. So.
Yeah, but as a player though, don't that honestly piss you off though? Because the year that you were, I know baseball is a silly game, like you said, but I'd be pissed personally because you were pitching good that year and the following year. And then all of a sudden they put you back in the minors. Don't that honestly like piss you off as a player knowing that you did well? And then all of a sudden, bam, you're back down in the minors for something you can't control.
Well, that's exactly what it is. It's something you can't control. So why dwell on it? Why get pissed off when the only thing that you can do to remedy it is to ultimately just go out there and pitch and reprove to everyone that you should be in the big leagues.
So tell us about your first major league win in that year that you were supposed to play that full year. Against the White Sox, where you gave up one run and 85 pitches. Tell us about your first career major league win. What do you remember most about it?
Truthfully, just being out there having fun. I mean, I've always been a pretty big optimist, and when I got the opportunity to start, mm-hmm. I didn't try and put too much pressure on myself. I basically just told myself, just go out there and mess with the hitters and keep them off balance and see where it goes. And sure enough, you know, it went well for me. So, you know, being in that division and facing those hitters for, you know, a majority of my career, it wasn't like I was going up against a brand new lineup that I've never faced before. So mm-hmm. I was fairly capable of knowing the scouting report before it was even put in front of me. And then, you know, with a few tweaks and making sure that you're pitching to your strengths and then also seeing what's working that day and what's not and adjusting your repertoire. With that being said, you know, that's the biggest challenge as a starter is you might not have all your pitches that day, so you got to figure out how to navigate that lineup with what you have working that day.
Yeah, because I see you were a spot-in starter because you, due to injuries to Francisco Arellano and Jordan Zimmermann, you were that call-up emergency starter for those couple starts you had in June, but you did good. You went 3-1 with a 3.66 ERA, but then once they come back, you get moved to the bullpen, and then you earn your first career save. Did you tell us about that game against the Toronto Blue Jays where you get your first save? I know you're not primarily a reliever, but you're anything basically. You're a, like you said, you pitched, you started, you relieved, but you weren't a closer. So tell us about that, getting your first major league save.
Again, right place, right time. It was one of those games where, I was basically one of the few relievers left out in the bullpen that were available. And I think one of our relievers who was supposed to close that day got off to a rough start, and things seemed to be snowballing. And I just happened to be the guy who got the call and went out there. And I think Curtis Granderson did me a favor and gave me a free out by bunting and moving the runner over. And then, it's one of those things where, that's how the game was played. Right. And yeah. It still kind of falls into that category. Obviously, it's a little bit different now with extra innings and runner on second and all that stuff. But right. It was just another outing that, I was probably more anxious for that than, my debut, because you're like, okay, well, it's either we win or we lose, and it's my fault, or it's on my shoulders if we win or we lose. So there is definitely a different mental mentality that closers have, and I respect them all for it, because it is crazy how quickly that game can catch up to in the final innings to potentially either win or lose it for your team.
So you know how position players get to keep their first home run, first hit. You as a pitcher, did you get to keep the ball when you won your first game and when you got your first strikeout or your first save? Did you ever get to keep the ball?
I have my first win ball. Detroit was really cool with respect to you would just have a lineup card in a frame show up in your locker when you obtain these accolades. Mm-hmm. And I have I think three or four framed lineup cards with embroidered plaque that says what actually happened on that day. So we got some memorabilia that we'll still haven't really found a proper home for it yet, but I'm sure we're not going to necessarily have a shrine, but we'll have some places to hang up these things at some point once we get this house completely finished. So
after that game with the Blue Jays, you go back to the rotation and you take a no-hitter into the seventh inning against the Oakland Athletics, and you lose it by an infield single by Jed Rowley to lose that no-hit bid. Did that have to suck, knowing that you were this close, six outs away, to getting a no-hitter?
I will tell you, I was a little bit bummed, but also relieved. Because I was running on fumes. I think I finished like 100. I don't know if it was 120, but it's like the pitch count was way up there. I don't think I threw past 90 pitches for any of my other starts. So to be that high into the pitch count and to be close, but not close enough to having a no-hitter, it was. It was definitely one of the things I will always cherish and remember, but things that people don't ever reflect back on. Olson hit two home runs foul off me in that game. Mm-hmm. And for, I think he might've been the only lefty in the lineup to be the guy who's giving me the most trouble is, kind of funny, but
right.
there was a little bit of luck involved, because, you know, if he's just a little bit later on that fastball or whatever pitch it was, you know, it's a fair ball and that's a home run.
Right, exactly. Now, did you have any nervousness going into that no-hit bid? Did the players – I know traditionally during a no-hit or when a pitcher is close to it, the players don't bother you in the dugout to keep you focused. Is that what happened to you when you were in that no-hit bid running, that the players did not bother you? You were in your own little zone? How nervous did that make you?
You know, it's – if for some reason it ever happens again – I don't want to be ignored in the dugout, because it really does kind of add to the anxiety, because your first couple innings, you know, you're pitching well and guys are joking around with you, and then all of a sudden you hit the fifth inning and you notice that the guys that have been joking around with you, you know, only half of them are talking to you now, and then you hit the sixth inning and all of a sudden no one's talking to you, and you're just like, I know what's going on. I don't need to be in my own little world, like, thinking about it even more. So,
right.
You know, it really does kind of add the anxiety, but at the same time, you know, players don't want to distract you from potentially doing something that not too many people have achieved.
Exactly. You're right on that. So now I got to ask you, What would you say, besides your major league debut and the success you had your rookie year, what would you say was your, oh my God, I'm officially here in the big leagues, this is my welcome to the big league moment? What was that moment for you?
Well, obviously debut is when you realize that you are on a very short list of players that have made it to the big leagues. It's crazy to actually go and look at how many big leaguers there have actually been, and that list is a lot shorter than you would think. But
right.
I would say once I started being used in games that actually mattered, so in 14, obviously, I was kind of like a mop-up guy for quite some time. And then all of a sudden, you know, here's a sixth inning tie ball game. And you're like, oh, okay, like, this is new. I'm, you know, being used and being relied on. And then that progresses to, okay, you need to get this lefty out. We're only up by one in the eighth. And, you know, it just slowly progresses to I'm not going to say being useful, but being relied on is, you know, a huge boost to your ego. And then also adds, you know, multiple amounts of anxiety at the same time. So, but, you know, you go into those situations and you realize that, okay, they trust me. They rely on me. I am truly a part of this team, and I'm helping this team win now.
Now, take us through your time with the Detroit, because you had some leadership in the locker room there with, of course, the big guy. You know who I'm referring to, Miggy. You had Victor, yep. Victor Martinez. You had pitchers like Scherzer for a little bit, Verlander for a little bit before they moved on. Well, yep. How was the leadership in that locker room? How were they as a leader, getting you guys ready for games? Were they as much as leaders as they were on the field?
Absolutely. You know, leaders come in different shapes and sizes, and Miggy led by example. He's kind of just like that little kid that never stopped being a little kid and just wants to go out and play baseball and have fun. Mm-hmm. And I think he was able to get the younger players coming up to realize that it's still a game. Mm-hmm. And then you go to guys like Verlander, who also, you know, led by example and was also a leader in the clubhouse. The most notable clubhouse leader that we had, and I think anyone who's played with him would realize it, and that's Torrey Hunter. Torrey Hunter was...
Yeah, that's right. I forgot about him. Yeah, he was with you guys for a while.
he was built to lead. I mean, we hit some skids, and all it took was a quick meeting from him, and things turned around almost immediately. I mean, he knew when the team needed to be talked to. He knew when to pull people aside. He was just so aware and had the leadership qualities needed to be a leader in the clubhouse because, frankly, you know, you usually have quite a few players that, you know, just want to do their own thing and want to have their own success. And the added responsibilities of being a leader, you know, are just too much for them to be able to also have the success for themselves. So with that being said, then you have a guy like Torrey Hunter, who I think focused more on the leadership qualities and being a leader in the clubhouse because he knew the team needed it to be successful as a whole. So, you know, with baseball, you also have different types of leaders with respect to, the bullpen kind of has their own leaders. The starting staff has their own leaders. The hitters have their own leaders. And the biggest thing is being able to have those groups coordinate with one another and become a team as a whole. And a guy like Torrey Hunter was able to do that.
So you as a pitcher coming up through the ranks as a rookie and all that, obviously you had those two as leaders helping you along the way, but they left. So who helped you out the most after they left? Was it any other veteran guy that you had there, or was it the pitching coaches? Who helped you along the way after those guys left?
Well, the coaching staff is always there to, you know, lead the team in the right direction. There are a few managers. I mean, with the Tigers, Brad was just coming off being a player, and he knew how to lead the team as a player, mm-hmm. and he, as well as a manager. But
right.
Then we got Ron Gardenhire, who's been around forever, right. and he's had good teams, he's had bad teams, and he knew exactly what needed to be said to each of those teams, whether they were good or bad, to you know, rally the troops and get them to play as a whole and win ball games. Once we lost a lot of our veteran guys in Detroit, you know, we had a few guys step up to try and fill the void, but with there still being a few veterans in there that weren't necessarily leaders, it almost felt like they were worried about stepping on toes to become, you know, the next Torrey Hunters. So I think it can be difficult to find the right leader at the right time, unless, you know, it's a career guy that's been in one spot his whole career. Like, for instance, Detroit. I mean, I know Mickey started in Miami, but once he made it to Detroit, you know, he was a Detroiter for life, pretty much.
Yeah.
And St. Louis, you got guys like Yadier Molina, Houston, you got Altuve. I mean, there's always that one or two players that, you know, they're lucky enough to find a home for that extended period of time. And baseball is a tough world for that because, you know, if you're not producing, you're either going to get traded, released, or have to find a new team as a free agent. So,
right.
Yeah.
Now, in your time there, how close did you guys come to making the playoffs, and how close were you guys to actually making it to the ultimate goal, which is World Series?
14, we made the playoffs. We're 3-0 against Baltimore. Mm-hmm. 15, I think we needed to win a two games out of a 3-game series against Atlanta for the final series. And I think we only won one game. So it was one of those scenarios where after the game was over, we were sitting in the locker room watching I don't even remember who it was. Actually, no. I think it was the Royals. Well, actually, it wasn't Royals. We were waiting on a wild card. But we needed, I think we needed like two teams to lose and one team to win. And after about 10 minutes of watching the games that were still going on, we realized that we were going to miss the playoffs by that one game. So, and then after that, it was kind of a downhill slide to try to rebuild that Detroit team back up. You know, the Illich family was still pumping money into the team, trying to make it a contender. And we just, with injuries and players not producing to the level they did the year before, you know, we weren't even close to making the playoffs. So,
now, did you ever get to go into any of those? Did you ever get to pitch in any of those playoff games that you were a part of? Or did you get to pitch?
I did not. So in 14, I missed the roster, the playoff roster. But I got to be there, which was really cool. Mm-hmm. And Baltimore was a blast. I mean, we lost, so it obviously sucked. But to be on the field for a playoff game was absolutely nuts. I mean, they handed out orange rally towels, and there's orange fuzz flying around the stadium. The whole series. And it was, you know, it was quite the experience.
Just like Pittsburgh with the terrible towels.
Yep.
Now, what about All-Star? Did you ever have the chance to be at an All-Star game, even though you didn't make it? Were you close to ever being an All-Star? How about that? Did you ever get to go?
No, because of the role, I'm not going to say it's rare, but I was never really in a role that was noticeable to being nominated as an All-Star. And, you know, and I'm perfectly fine with that. You know, people make their careers in professional baseball, and guys that I played with, you know, in the All-Star games was, you know, a true blessing in itself, because you're like, well, that guy was my teammate and now he's an All-Star game. So,
yeah. But did you ever get to go personally just by yourself or whatever, family? Did you ever get to go just to witness it and experience the home run derby and the game itself?
Not when I was playing. So growing up in Seattle, we did get to go, me and my dad, to an All-Star game. Actually, I think we went to the home run derby and the All-Star game. Mm-hmm. And it was, you know, quite the experience to kind of see players out there competing, but not necessarily like, you know, do or die situation. They're out there having fun, you know, kind of just makes you realize that baseball is a game that's supposed to be fun. So, to see some of the greats throughout that season all on one field is, you know, it's fun to watch.
So after you leave the Tigers, the Minnesota Twins sign you on November 26th of 2019. You sign a minor league contract with them, your rival team, another rival team. But unfortunately, you missed the year with Tommy John surgery, and that is the COVID year. Aren't you glad you kind of missed that year, even though you were rehabbing? I mean, that would have been hard to play in kind of like no fans, basically practice. That would have been tough for you, wouldn't it, as a player, to play
with fans? Absolutely.
How would you have
fans? We got to see 1 month of what the alternate site looked like when I was with the Brewers last year. And it wasn't fun. I mean, scratch it. It was fun, but it was repetitive and it got old really quick. And thankfully, you know, that season started up. But for me to miss 2020 was almost a blessing, because if that season would have started on time, I don't know if I would have opted to get the internal brace that I did. So it was like a Tommy John light version, basically the rehab time's cut in half. But
right.
To be able to not only get myself back to being healthy, but also to be able to kind of get, you know, a look into what the future might be with being able to spend time with the family at the house over the summer, because, well, I haven't had a summer in almost 20 years. And it was a lot of fun, and it also made me realize how much I miss baseball. So to be able to play last year was, you know, a lot of fun, and also just made me realize how much, you know, I've been in baseball and loved every minute of it.
Now, I know you obviously, you missed it. Like you tell me now, it was a blessing you did, because I don't know how you would have fared in it. But it was a 60-game season. Do you like how baseball handled it? Because there was a lot of COVID still being around. A lot of cases, games being scheduled, postponed, etc. So do you like the way baseball had handled it? Or do you think they should have gone bubble-wise like they did in the playoffs? Like they did for the playoffs. Do you think they should have did that whole season as a bubble?
Yes and no. I really don't know how successful a bubble actually would have been, especially with 30 teams at a roster size of whatever it was, 25 or 26. You know, that's a lot of players, and, you know, all it takes is one player to not follow the guidelines of that bubble. Mm-hmm. And sure enough, you're going to have an outbreak between all 30 teams instead of, you know, potentially having to cancel a series or two here and there between multiple teams. I think they handled it okay. I think there's things they could have done better. I think there's things they did really well. And then this last year, I think they realized what they needed to alter to make it a little bit more efficient, and, you know, who knows how the protocols are this year, but I'm sure that they're a lot more relaxed with the majority of the players being vaccinated, and they're just, you know, trying to prevent future outbreaks. But, you know, I think we're also at a passing point where life must go on, and just try and keep everyone safe and healthy. And if it happens to pop up, then, you know, you go through the protocols and make sure everything returns back to normal when it can.
Now, like you said, we were just in a, you guys were just in the lockout, a major league lockout. Now, last year you obviously were with the Brewers minor league. Did you have any idea at the end of the year, even though you were going to get cut by them anyhow, did you know at the end of the year that you guys were going to go through a lockout, that you couldn't sign with anybody?
Yeah. Pretty much every player knew it was going to happen. The owners knew it was going to happen. Everyone was basically prepped for it. We just didn't know how long it was going to last. And with how the negotiations went, I mean, the fact that I forget how many days it was, but I think it was a ridiculous amount of days before there was negotiations even taking place, which is kind of sad to say, because both sides realized, you know, everyone's going to miss out on some form of money if they do this, and they did. So, you know, it sucks how everything went, and there's quite a few guys that slipped through the cracks because of it, including myself, which, I mean, I'd like to think that if there was no lockout, that I'd be playing minor league baseball somewhere, or, I mean, even major league baseball. Right. But that's not the path that was put in front of me. And, you know, I'm going to try and make the most out of going to Sioux City and proving to people that I still got it, and exactly, hopefully
find myself. That's all you can ask for, right? That's all you can ask for.
Yeah.
Now, obviously, you pitched for three of the teams in the rough and tough AL North. I guess, yeah, that's North Division, right?
Yeah. Oh, Central.
Central, yeah, sorry. Yeah. I got my teams mixed up there, because I'm more of a NL West guy, Padre, because I'm a Padre fan.
Yeah.
So I'm more of NL. But, yeah, you got to play with three of those teams. Well, obviously, the Twins, unfortunately, you didn't get to play for them, but you were still a part of them. And obviously, the Royals, and obviously, the team you spent the longest for, the Tigers. How rough and tough was playing in that division when you were a Tiger between those three teams? Because I know the White Sox, they were going downhill, but they still had some core players. And I know, obviously you had the, like we talked about, the Royals, they were starting to get good. And then you had the Twins, they were still making the playoffs, and they were had good key players. Was there a legit rivalry amongst you guys, or was there just respect factor against you for with all you guys?
I think because of my path and being able to play with quite a few guys within that division coming up through the minors. And then also I felt like when I was with Detroit, we played Cleveland like 30 games a year, and yeah, Cleveland had our number. And it was just one of those teams where it's like, oh, well, we're playing Cleveland again. Great. Just faced their whole lineup. I got to try and figure out who I need to adjust my approach on and who I can keep pitching the way I have been with success. And, you know, it's the one difficult thing about how baseball is laid out with the divisions is you play your division. I couldn't tell you the exact number, but it feels like half the year.
Right.
And because of that, you're constantly facing the same hitters over and over and over again, especially as a reliever, because you know there's the matchups and whatnot, and you know lineups are interchanging year to year. But you know, for each year, I think with Cleveland, I had to face Santana, Lindor, someone else, and then Brantley at least 20 times a year, it felt like. Mm-hmm. And you know, after about four or five, you start to reflect on how you pitched them the times before, and then you're kind of playing a chess match in your head, like, do they remember? Do I remember? Okay, I did this last time. Do you think he's going to sit on this pitch? Should I change, or should I stay with, you know, the pitch that I threw the last time? And sometimes you overthink it, and it ends up biting you in the butt. But other times, it's beneficial to know how past the bats with those certain players have gone and what you might need to do to adjust and basically win the chess match between the two.
So three more questions before I let you go, because I know it's getting late here and it's getting late over there. First one is a two-part question. What was your pitching repertoire like in the minors and pro? And what was your go-to pitch to get a hitter out?
For me, I've always been fastball, curveball, cutter, changeup. As I said earlier in our interview, coming up in my first couple of years, I was really only a fastball changeup guy with an okay breaking ball. Right. You know, I knew how to throw a slider. I knew how to throw a curveball, but they never worked together. So I was always fighting myself, trying to figure out which one I should go with. And then when I transformed the slider into a cutter, then I was able to actually get the cutter and the curveball to work on the same days. For me, my go-to pitch has always been a changeup. Every hitter dictates what I'm going to throw to him. It took me quite a few years in the majors to be able to throw a changeup to lefties. So I had to throw my cutter to the lefties and my changeup to the righties. And then finally, I got the confidence needed to throw my changeup to lefties. And there was a lot of success there, but there was also if I didn't make my pitch, those lefties would make me pay for throwing that changeup into them. So.
Mm-hmm. Now, the next one is, it's also a two-part, another two-part question is, obviously, we talked about Alex Gordon, who you played with, and he was one of the guys that hit well against you. But besides him, who'd you have the most effectiveness against? And who hit you besides him the most?
Well, when it comes to reflecting on effectiveness, really, as a pitcher, I don't remember those as much as I do the guys who hit well off me. Being in the Central, Brantley had my number, Maurer had my number. And like with Maurer, it was never, there wasn't like really bad damage that he did against me, but he just always got on base. And it didn't matter what you threw him, because he'd give you strike one. So you go 0-1, you go, okay. And then he's got such a good eye and he's got an approach, so you can somehow get to strike two. And then it gets really hard because his plate discipline and his knowledge of where the strike zone was so good that didn't matter what you threw him, he'd foul it off if it wasn't the pitch he was looking for, and then all of a sudden you make a mistake and it's a ground ball up the middle, or you know, a ball in the gap, and you're just shaking your head going, I should have just, you know, thrown three straight fastballs down the middle and hope for the best. But Brantley, I kind of went back and forth with, you know, I had a little success against him in the early stages, and then I think he got the scouting report on me, and the tides changed fairly quickly. And that's the issue with being a lefty is, you know, you were usually viewed as a loogie and you were used just to face the main lefties in those lineups. So I did have a good amount of success until the later years against Cleveland with, you know, Lindor and Santana and, you know, a few of those other guys. But that was mainly because those guys were switch hitters. My changeup's my best pitch, and it's a lot better against righties than lefties.
So now I got to ask you, now that we talked a little about Cleveland, I got to ask you, did you like how that went about, how they had to change your name? Because I think that was ridiculous. Pandemic year happened, and I forget his name now, but you get what I'm saying. How that came about, after that, then all this hate that came about, and then it's still ridiculous to me how they had to change the name and the logo, and Native Americans weren't even upset with that, but they still changed it. Like, don't you think that was kind of stupid that the ownership took that way and having to change it? Indians for so long, Native Americans didn't have an issue with it. Like, they didn't have an issue with it, so why change it?
You know, the world's changing, you know, and I don't think they should have had to have changed their name, especially as quickly as they did. You know, they could have potentially transitioned into a different name, you know, decades down the road, but they're just trying to keep the fans happy. And truthfully, I don't think they realized how much of a backlash they were going to get from their true fans. And that guy saw a post of fans at Cleveland games, and they said the stands were ultimately flowing with all the Indian gear and Guardian.
They're upset.
Merchandise. So
exactly, they're upset, and I don't blame them. I mean, it's ridiculous just because something happened, and I could see if Native Americans were complaining, but they weren't. They weren't complaining at all about the name. It was fine to use that and the logo. They weren't complaining. I could see if they were complaining, but they weren't complaining. So why? You don't have to change it, even though everything else has changed. I mean, I get what happened. I get the world, but I mean, seriously, if they're not complaining, don't do it. It was fine the way it was.
No, I completely agree. And like, I think I'm 1/16th Native American, and obviously
same. That's probably what I am. Yeah, Cherokee.
Yeah, it's been a part of my life. My mom is very in tune with her Native American heritage, and her whole side of the family is too. And you know, we're obviously not living on a reservation, but you know, we're still Native American to agree. And, you know, I don't think there should have been any offense taken to a team called the Indians. You know, it happened in football with the Redskins. You know, they're obviously the Washington football team, which grew on me pretty quickly. But
it did.
When it first changed and I was watching a game and I'm like, why does it say football team on the bottom of the screen? Yeah. Like, what happened? And I slowly realized that that was actually their name. Like, yeah. I just thought that was their.
They're now called the Commanders.
Yeah. But, you know, and that could have totally been a route that Cleveland could have gone too, instead of rushing into choosing a new team name and logo. But at the same time, like, I don't think they really needed to change. But, you know, it's a new world, and it's kind of the path we're going right now.
So, obviously, you had to luxury of playing in Detroit, and you faced most of the division rivals, obviously, in Minnesota, Kansas City, Cleveland, Chicago, all the cold places, especially in the springtime when it's cold. Where would you say was your favorite place to pitch in the whole season, whether it be hot, cold? Where was your favorite place to pitch, and what fan base did you enjoy the most?
Oh, I mean, I would say Detroit, just because, you know, it's a pitcher's park. From a, you know, pitching standpoint, from a fan base, Detroit was always really good, and those fans were always loyal. You know, they obviously had the rebuilding years, which kind of put a damper on, you know, that fan base, but I think they're slowly coming back. I love the Twins Stadium because it's built up. Mm-hmm. So there's really not a bad seat in the ballpark, whereas like Detroit's built out. So if you're in the very far upper deck, you know, you're like a mile away from the pitcher's mound, which, you know, every stadium is built different. But I like Detroit because I like the bullpens. The bunkers were pretty cool. Mm-hmm. Now there's more and more teams that have that bunker feel to it. You know, the Cubs finally moved their bullpen off field. And now you're kind of in that weird realm of you don't even feel like you're at the game because you're inside watching a TV to be able to keep track of the game.
Yeah.
Same thing with the Yankees, but at least the Yankees are a hybrid where they have that indoor spot. And then you also have like the mounds that are out actually within the stands. And then if you really want to, you can watch a game from the bleachers that are also out there, but who really wants to be cussed at, you know, 24/7 by those fans? So
yeah, exactly. I agree. I'm gonna ask you more questions too once I'm done with you. I'll text you as well, because I'll definitely stay in touch during the season as well. But I want to ask you this final question before I let you go, and I'll text you when we're done here as well. The final question is a two-part question. I ask this to everybody. If you were a coach, obviously you're still playing, but if you were a coach, what would you tell anybody that wants to get to your level? What would you tell them to help them get to your level? And the second part is define your career so far in one word.
For me, my advice would be just don't take a day off from trying to get better. This game has such a capacity to be able to pass you up so quickly. And if you don't stay at the same speed as everyone else that's around you, you know, it will pass you up. So whether it be, you know, trying to get stronger or trying to perfect your pitches so, you know, you can throw them to each side of the plate and, you know, be able to throw strikes with all your off speed. Because, I mean, the higher the level you go, the more important off speed is, unless you got a blazing fastball. And to have that is a gift. It's not something that, you know, you can train to throw I mean, you can train to throw harder, but you can't train to throw upper 90s and the hundreds. So,
right.
And then for the one word to describe my career, that's tough.
It can be two if you want. It don't have to be just one.
I would say resilience.
There you go.
You know, I've been time and time again basically shown that regardless of what other people think, if you continue to prove to people that you are capable, someone will notice and you will get your opportunities.
Without a doubt. I couldn't have said it any better. I will send you the episode so you can post it when we're done. I'll also, like I said, I'll text you some more, especially during the season, because I know that's starting and it's heating up so far. I've got some interesting games so far.
Oh, yeah.
It's heating up, and I wish you the best in your upcoming season. Hope you get scouted, and hope you make another pro team. And be interested to see you pitch in an actual MLB game again. So it'll be interesting. Can't wait for that. But until then, it was fun. Thank you again. I'm definitely going to stay in touch with you.
Appreciate it, Byron.
Have a good night. Is there anything else you want to add on, like for anybody to follow you, watch you at? Etc. Anything you want to add before we go?
No, I think we're good. I think we had a pretty good talk, and I think, you know, hopefully the people that watch this, they you know, get some insight and maybe help some younger guys get to some professional baseball. So
perfect. Couldn't have said it any better. I'll definitely send that over to you and chat some more. All right. Have a good night.
Awesome. Sounds good. Take good care. Night.
Be safe. Good night. Blaine Hardy, everybody. Current pitcher of the Sox City. Wants to get back into majors. Hope he does. Wish him the best. But former pitcher for the Tigers, Twins, Royals. Very fun conversation. Definitely will stay in touch with him. I don't know who I'm going to have yet for 100. I don't know yet. I know that's coming. So I want it to be special, so I don't know. I don't know who I'm going to have. I might have on an MMA fighter. I don't know who. We'll see. But until then, follow us on YouTube at Coffee Time with Byron. On all available podcasting apps, Spotify, Google, iHeart, Apple, and now Amazon Music. Just ask Alexa. All at Coffee Time with Byron. And until then, be safe. Have a good night, and this concludes episode number 99 with Blaine Hardy. Take care.